his motion and causing him to swing in place until he stopped. Yu Imam looked over and spotted him. "Captain!" The man unstrapped himself from the console he was working on and drifted over to James's location. "May I be of service, sir?"
"Yes, thank you, Chief," James said. "I've been looking over our inventory and trying to work out a doctrine that's feasible against the Imperial forces, and I wanted to speak with you about the warp drive."
Yu cringed slightly. "Captain, if this is about the maneuver done by my countrymen during the invasion, I strongly advise that be considered a final option only. Destabilizing the warp field is not kind to the drives."
James put up his hands, chuckling dryly. "Not that specifically, no. And I fully agree, Chief. We'll not blow our warp field unless we've exhausted all other options. From what I understand, it would be of limited value against the Imperial ships anyway, since they use gravity drives to warp space themselves. The high-energy particles would be attenuated by their drives unless we caught them with their pants down."
Yu looked puzzled as he worked his way through the captain's phrasing, then nodded as relief washed over him.
"Precisely, Captain. I am pleased that you have been studying the mechanism," the chief said. "Since you are not asking me to rupture space-time and destroy my drives, what service may I provide, Captain?"
James smiled slightly, almost despite himself. "I wanted to inquire as to the difference between the catamass tech we use and the warp drive itself."
"Ah," Yu nodded slowly. "That answer is rather technical, but in the simplest terms, Captain, the countermass technology is only one half of a warp drive."
He trailed off, thinking his way through his response.
"Strictly speaking, a warp drive is simply two opposed countermass fields. One is providing a negative mass effect, while the other is providing a positive mass effect."
"Our missiles do that already," James said.
"Yes, but only one effect at any given moment," Yu said. "Lessen mass to accelerate, increase mass to provide more kinetic impact. A warp drive must do both at once and project the effect away from the ship."
James considered that for a moment. "So we could put warp fields on our missiles if we doubled up the CM generators and found a way to project the field?"
"Ah, you wish for hyperlight missiles, yes? I understand. Yes, this could be done. However, the missiles would have to be much larger, and the range would be rather short, I'm afraid."
"Short?"
"Yes, the balance would be nearly impossible to maintain," Yu said. "The reasons are difficult to break down easily, but even for tactical ranges, one would have to get remarkably close to the enemy."
"How close?"
"In combat terms, inside the enemy's point defenses, sir. Within 100,000 kilometers at best," Yu answered.
To James, the chief was clearly right. That was close in Black Navy terms. Ships would never survive closing to that range, not against the overwhelming force the enemy had brought to the table, at least. Ships wouldn't.
"Could you make the modifications?" he asked quietly.
"Captain, the range issues..."
"More importantly," James interrupted, holding up a hand, "could you make these modifications to the Vorpal's missiles?"
Yu shifted back, surprised and thoughtful.
"Possibly," he admitted. "It would reduce the payload overall, however."
"Do it," James ordered. "Figure out how to alter our missiles and do it. We're going to need every edge we can get, and if that means we have to send our Vorpals into the teeth of the enemy, well, that's what they signed up for. Just make sure that when they're there, they have a real weapon in their hands, Chief."
"I will do what can be done, Captain,"
Yu said, mind clearly racing as he considered the captain's request.
"Thank you," James said, pushing back on the hand grip. "As you were, Chief."
Chapter 14 AEV Boudica, MARTA System, Primine Space.
"Gravity waves inbound, Skipper."
Captain Hyatt nodded grimly. She'd been expecting that announcement for several hours, and the tension had slowly been ratcheting up as the time wore on. It was almost a relief to hear it finally, but only almost. The precursor of the inbound fleet's gravity waves could be detected in quantum flux if you knew what you were looking at and had an idea of what was coming. That was a good thing.
because if they had to wait for the actual gravity shift to be detected, the enemy would be among them before the gravity boom of their passing could be detected. Faster-than-light technology presented many unique and headache-inducing problems for the captain of a warship.
"Understood," she said. "Stand by to initiate."
"Aye, aye, ma'am," her tactical and weapons expert, Lieutenant Commander Jeff Maxim, answered. "Initiation ready on your command."
Hyatt examined the readings. "Hold for my signal."
She keyed open a laser link to the Bellerophon.
"Captain Roberts, we've detected the quantum bow shock of the enemy formation. Standing by to enable the system."
The laser went out, taking several moments before she received a reply.
"Roger that, Captain Hyatt." Roberts' quiet voice came back finally.
"Initiate at your discretion. Bellerophon will follow your lead."
"Understood, Captain. Good luck, good hunting."
Hyatt sent, before killing the comm and putting the ship's systems as dark as could be managed. Hiding a heroic-class ship from gravity detection was not an insignificant task, unfortunately, which was what had led them to their current situation. The Boudicca was parked in extremely close orbit of a cold planetoid roughly two-thirds the mass of Earth. It had no atmosphere, which was the only reason they were in a technical orbit and not flying a few miles off the surface. But the planetoid massed enough that any passive scan of the system would conclude that the bow's mass was simply part of the planetoid. Active scans would be trickier, but those had to be directed, and space was a big place. If the enemy got suspicious of the planetoid for some reason and focused their attention there, things would likely get problematic. Barring that, however, Hyatt figured that they should be safe. For a certain version of safe. Nowhere in the entire system was what she would consider safe, of course not with an Imperial flotilla about to bear down on them.
"Ma'am, triangulation from the bell confirmed," Maxim said firmly. "We're in the hot seat, ma'am."
That didn't surprise her. The initial scans seemed to indicate that the enemy were coming their way. Based on the data they'd received from the Prometheus rogues, Hyatt and Roberts had figured out the most likely approach vector to the system and parked themselves as best they could to cover the widest aspect of those vectors. As luck would have it, she supposed, the Boudicca was up.
"Initiate the system,"
she ordered as some of the readings she was watching on the tactical repeaters changed.
"Aye, ma'am. Initiating,"
Maxim confirmed instantly.
"Well, that's it. Game on."
Lord's own dreadnought, Empress Leon. Yesan overlooked the main screens as the ships approached the target system, though there was nothing really to see. When moving faster than light, the effects of universal laws were such that real-time viewing became effectively impossible. The computers could reverse-engineer the effect pattern given time, but not within anything that resembled a reasonable tactical time frame. So he stared at the raw spattering of color displayed on the screen, wavelengths of light that were actually invisible to the naked eye under normal circumstances, but were now shifted into visibility while other wavelengths were made invisible as a result of their great speed.
"Sector Lord, we're approaching the deceleration point," the ship's commander announced respectfully.
"Very well, Captain. You may make the approach at your discretion," Meesh said simply, his voice and tone doing nothing to betray his interest in what was coming.
Since he'd heard about the troubles the Navark squadrons had encountered during their penetrations of the Othar worlds, he'd been fascinated by what might be discovered there. Real challenges were quite rare for one of his rank and power. Meesh kept his posture commanding as the orders were given and the ship's hum shifted subtly, the lights on the main display wavering as the vessel reversed its acceleration to the outer system they had chosen for their first approach. He didn't really expect much to happen here. The little planet was by all reports rather unimpressive within even the Othar's limited colonial reach, but it was part of enemy territory. The screen stabilized a moment later, and he found himself looking at what could be the view from nearly any system in the galaxy. The star was a distant point of light in the center of their screens, a white dot in the speckled black. Nothing special, certainly nothing to hint that there was anything present other than just that point of light. At first, that was all he saw, all there was to see, really. That changed as the computers began to catch up to the sublight scans they had available, comparing them to library records of the system. From what Imperial Intelligence and the Navark squadrons had acquired, the local planets were filled in on the screen as the computer located each of them in turn, and then highlighted their position in the black with a red box and another point of colored light. "No signs of any oath or activity, my lord," the ship's commander announced a few moments later. "Gravity scans show nothing out of the ordinary for the system, according to library records."
"Pity," Yesan supposed. He almost wished that there had been a small squadron waiting for them. A few ships would have been enough for him to get a measure of the enemy without unduly risking his command.
"Very well. Take us in. Vector for the Other Colony."
"On your orders, my lord. Fleet command to all ships," the commander said. "Vector information follows. All ahead, 3/4 power.
The distant hum of the reactor drives shifted again, as did the light visible on the screens, neither quite so drastically as they had before, while the ships launched themselves downwell of the local sun. With gravity helping them, the fleet made fast progress as they began the long fall starward.
"Signals detected from the colony planet, fleet lord."
Yesan looked over to where the communication officer had spoken.
"Anything concerning us yet?"
"Not yet, my lord. Merely the normal communications one might expect from a new colony," the officer admitted.
"Continue to monitor. I want to know when they detect us."
"Yes, my lord."
Yesan was feeling fidgety, he found, like he couldn't quite sit still. Something was missing. Something had to be missing. Then one of the lights representing a ship in his fleet blinked out, and every alarm in the Empress Leon went off in a screaming mess as the screens shifted to show the vessel. Fires were burning in space. Yesan rose up from his seat, shocked, his eyes wide as he looked over the scene. What happened? The CM mine was a relatively simple piece of technology, really. Just a dumb computer connected to a powerful CM generator and a Primine power capacitor. The generator had its vibratory currents reversed from the normal settings, making it much closer to what was known as a Kubelblitz than a traditional CM device. That meant that when the command to initiate was given by the Boudicca, the little inoffensive device became what might be best described as a Mr. Hyde version of its normally pleasant self. Instead of lowering the effective mass effect of everything within its sphere of influence, the mine increased the effective mass. By rather a lot. The Imperial ship unknowingly sucked the device into its own forward wave trough, part of the gravity wave that allowed the warp drive of the vessel to apparently break the laws of the universe and travel faster than light. Inside that already warped space, however, the mine activated and went terminal. The result was that the wave trough suddenly deepened incredibly, sucking the ship forward into its own drive warp. The deep sinkhole in space and time that pulled the ship along suddenly expanded dangerously, its outer edge intersecting with the Imperial craft. That alone would be enough to strain the superstructure and possibly even the hull of the ship, but not remotely enough to cause it any serious damage. The sudden appearance of an event horizon within the gravity sinkhole, however, changed things rapidly. In an instant, a true singularity sucked in the mine, destroying it instantly from the point of view of the mine, but leaving the locale an eternal pit from the perspective of all observers beyond the event horizon. Eternal, of course, until the newly formed event horizon expanded, eating up all the particles and energy that had been unwillingly stored in the ship's warp wave. With that energy and mass added, its growth jumped again, reaching beyond the warp in space-time that the ship had carefully formed and stretching out for the ship itself. Once the event horizon crossed the edge of the vessel's bow, everything went to hell for those on board. AEV Boudicca.
Oh, God.
Hyatt didn't look around to see who had spoken. She didn't care. She wasn't actually feeling all that great about what she was looking at either. The small artificial singularity they had introduced to the path of the enemy squadron was not remotely enough to do what they'd just seen, not under normal circumstances at least. However, when planted right into the forward warp of an accelerating warship, the numbers they had worked out were clearly correct. In many ways, Hyatt almost wished they hadn't been.
"Sweet Jesus, would you look at that?"
The bow of the enemy ship couldn't take the strain, and the armor spaghettified. From the perspective of the Boudicca,
The armor was just torn to shreds and sucked into a spiral around the singularity. Explosions rocked the ship as critical systems were torn apart, and fires erupted as gases escaped into space. Hyatt refused to look away.
"Tell me again, that isn't stable," she ordered softly.
"No, ma'am," Commander Maxim said, his voice sickly. "The singularity shouldn't have the mass to remain stable. It should explode any time." He was cut off as the front of the Imperial ship suddenly vanished in an explosion of pure energy. Hyatt flinched, shaking her head.
"All right. I'd say we just delivered a line in the sand," she said firmly, forcing down the bile in her gut.
"Do we have any? There's another one!"
Again, she didn't look to see who had spoken.
The scene of another ship being torn to shreds, in part by its own warp wave, transfixed her.
Hyatt stared silently until that vessel suddenly exploded in a flash of brilliant energy. "Lord, forgive us," she whispered. "This is insanity."
Imperial Fleet, Deep Space. "All stop! All vessels stop!" Navark Misrem screamed over the command channel, her own ship dumping velocity as quickly as it could. The explosions of two ships had made it clear to her that they'd bumbled somehow into a minefield. She strode over to the scanning station, eyes wild as she glared at the technician.
"Find those weapons," she snarled.
Yes, Navark. The Others, or more likely, to her estimation, the anomaly species, had spotted their approach and prepared a welcome this time. Not entirely unexpected, but still impressive.
"It's almost like they were watching our approach for some time already," Misrem thought, the sarcasm dripping even in her own mind. She knew those damn invisible ships had caused this. The enemy's destroyers were so hard to detect that they could have had pickets observing all the way from Imperial territory, sending intelligence on their course back to the ambushers here, and there was damn little that the fleet could have done about it.
She'd screamed for an all-stop, and thankfully most of the sector fleet had responded with some modicum of common sense.
"How many ships?" Misrem asked tersely, eyes darting to the screens. "How many have we lost?"
"Three, four, Navark," her second answered, wincing as he delivered the correction.
"What type of weapons are those?" "At a guess, some type of singularity generator." She sighed. "They are clearly sending a message."
Her second looked over at her with wide eyes.
"That would be a significant message, Navark. Singularity weapons are banned by Imperial edict." "I find it unlikely that they signed on to that agreement," Misrem responded dryly. "Not that signing it has stopped the Empire when times called for special deployment."
"Navark, the Sector Lord wishes to speak with you, my lady."
Misrem groaned but waved an acknowledgement. "To my station."
Yesan glowered at the screen when it cleared to show Navark Misrem falling heavily into her seat.
"What just happened?" he snarled.
"You likely know more than I," she said wearily, "but at a guess I would say that we entered the kill zone of a hastily prepared minefield."
"Hastily prepared? Why do you think that?"
Yesan asked, unbelieving.
"Simply because we've only lost four ships, my lord," she answered succinctly. "Had they had time to lay this properly, we could have lost 10% of our forces instead of less than one. The Others and their allies are giving notice here, my lord."
"I will see this notice of theirs shoved deeply up there."
"Peace, my lord." Misrem held up a hand. "I agree. For the moment, however, we must deal with the current issue. We should scan the local area intently, identify any more weapons, and eliminate them."
Yesan took a breath.
"Of course. Consider the orders issued." "Very well, my lord. I will return to my work," she said before bowing her head. "My apologies for issuing fleet commands, my lord. It was not my place."
Yesan settled back, looking at her over the screen intently for a moment, before he suddenly waved a hand idly.
"Please, Navark. That is of no matter. You were quite correct in this instance. You have my gratitude."
He smiled thinly, leaving no doubt between them that his gratitude was entirely dependent on her success. Had she overstepped her bounds to such a degree and been wrong, That would have been a very different story, with a much uglier outcome for the Navark.
Thank you for your understanding, my lord. Miss Rem bowed her head again. I live to serve.
Yesan nodded, dismissing her, but staring at the blank screen for some time after it had gone dark. Miss Rem, he decided, was an ambitious and intelligent woman. Despite her previous failures, his impression and her record said that failing was something she was largely unfamiliar with. She could be a valuable ally, he decided, for a time at least. Eventually, if she were permitted to gain sufficient power, he had no doubt that she would be far more of a deficit than an asset.
I believe I will keep this one close, for a time, Yesan decided.
Once this operation was complete, he would have uses for a disposable asset like her. He always had uses for disposable assets. Yesan got up and walked across the command deck as the computers began lighting up with detections and opening fire on the destructive little annoyances that lay in their path. Proceed ahead, he ordered. Slowly. All scanners active. Find and clear those things from my space.
Yes, my lord, the commander answered. All ships ahead slow. Scan and destroy targets as they are detected.
AEV Boudica.
Well, it was fun while it lasted, Hyatt said, her stomach churning again.
She'd thought watching the little singularity bombs tear ships apart was a gut-wrenching feeling, but that was nothing compared to watching the massive fleet start shooting them out of space as it began to lumber slowly forward again. They'd deployed hundreds of the little lethal balls of quantum tech, and in return, they got four ships. Four. She wasn't sure there were enough munitions in the entire reserves of the Earth and Primine militaries combined to do much more than blunt the edge of the Imperial advance. She hoped she was wrong, but then she had hoped to get a couple dozen ships with the impromptu minefield.
Orders, ma'am? Tell engineering to figure out how to put cam plates on those damn things. Maybe we'll be able to sneak a few more past them next time.
Yes, ma'am. Her first officer responded. But, I meant right now.
Orders? Stay deep, stay silent, she snapped. What the hell else are we going to do?
He sighed, relaxing.
Yes, ma'am.
Honestly, Hyatt fumed, did he think she would order a frontal assault? She doubted even Weston would be so foolish as to entertain that idea in this case. Whatever happened to the colony now, it was out of their control.
Record everything. She ordered, just record everything.
Chapter 15 AEV Odysseus Rankiel System.
This is what we are to be building, Mila said firmly, displaying a conceptual sketch as well as rough diagrams to the group of assembled engineers. The captain wishes to have drones with the capacity... Well, suffice to say, the captain will get what he has asked for.
The engineers shifted a little uneasily. They could read the specs as well as she could, and many of them were a little less than eager about the project themselves. Still, she was right. They would get the captain what he'd asked for, assuming it was remotely possible. The designs were straightforward, thankfully. Those who were familiar with antimatter were pleased to note that containment was far simpler, given that there would be no need for the extreme precision of magnetic containment used on board starships, such as the Rogue or Odyssey class. The drones had no need of atmosphere, so the entire storage area would be evacuated and largely open to space. That would allow them to use a more forgiving containment system to hold the antimatter charges while awaiting deployment orders. Rearming the drones would be the usual nightmare, of course, but that would be a problem for the future. The drones were to have a sharp-pronged forward bow, a large bulbous sphere to contain the warping core to the rear, and a central open area that would hold the charges. The design was simple and elegant, and terrified the engineers like few other things they'd seen. Mila calmly walked them through the assembly steps while the Odysseus's automated fabrication systems built the parts they hadn't transshipped from the forge. Mostly, these were space frame pieces, along with structure and custom containment arrays, easily fabricated once the designs had been finalized. When she was done,
Mila turned and set her eyes on the part of the project she had chosen for herself. Odysseus quietly observed the work, standing off to one side but remaining visible. He could, of course, be everywhere on the ship without being seen. In a way, he was, for there was nothing he could do to shut off the thoughts that formed in his mind in every given moment. Each plan, fantasy, musing, and daydream of each and every one of the ship's 843 crew members were part of his consciousness. It was a strange sensation, or he believed it was at first, to think thoughts that were less than complimentary toward himself. The idea that perhaps he should be killed passed through his mind every few seconds when someone was in any way thinking about him. Even the captain caused such thoughts to materialize in Odysseus's mind. However, he also felt the firm belief that all life had value, and that his right to existence was inviolate, right up until the moment when he chose to violate someone else's rights to the same. That, too, came from the captain, among others. The dichotomy of the thoughts were such that Odysseus didn't even try to straighten them out within his own mind. Assuming anything could be entirely considered to be his own, humans had self-destructive thoughts with a frequency that Odysseus suspected would horrify most. From actual suicidal thoughts, thankfully rare, to the occasional what-if questions as they looked into the Singularity Core, which even Odysseus found exceedingly disturbing. Humans thought about ways of killing themselves far more often than they thought about how to kill him. Perhaps a cold comfort of sorts, but it was what Odysseus had for the moment. Humans were a destructive sort, seemingly by nature. There was nothing personal about it. So Odysseus largely did what humans did, and ignored those passing thoughts, letting them slide by while giving them no weight. He didn't know if the process was healthy, to be honest, despite the musings of several PhDs among the crew who had opinions on the subject. Their thoughts, being part of his mental processing, helped him better comprehend what he was doing, just not whether it was a good idea. With those issues safely put aside, Odysseus focused on the drive that he had inherited from his crew, which was deeper than any of those passing thoughts. The men and women on board were focused, deeply intent on the defense of a world he had no personal memory of having seen. Earth. Odysseus had viewed the digital records, but he preferred the idealized image that most of the crew held in their minds. A sparkling white and blue jewel set against a black infinity, Earth was at the core of an entire belief system that he found himself entrenched in. He was enough of a philosopher to wonder if this was what children brought up in deeply religious families experienced. But like his namesake, Odysseus was a warrior at his core, and matters of philosophy were best left for peacetime. There was a time for philosophy, but this was not that time. The crew members had little time to think, each department head conducting drills and pushing them to peak efficiency, mostly as a means of keeping everyone busy. Too many bad and questionable things were preying on the crew's fears and concerns. Leaving them with time to think about such affairs would be asking for nothing but trouble. Eric, for the most part, left his officers to handle their departments while he oversaw as much of the various efforts underway as he could. The Odysseus was already worked up to about as high a level of efficiency as could reasonably be managed, such that, under normal circumstances, he'd have stepped on any new efficiency drills just for concerns that they would inadvertently blunt the already finely honed skills of the crew. With as many distractions and worries as were floating about, however, he was willing to sacrifice a few points of efficiency from fatigue if it kept the crew from worrying about the haunted ship, or the damned flotilla bearing down on them all. Worrying about those things was his job. Eric checked the timestamp on his personal system, noting that the Big E and any other reinforcements the Admiral could scrounge together would shortly be arriving in system. With those, as well as what ships the Primine could supply, the Odysseus would move out to enforce the Bell and the Bow and Primine frontline vessels. It wouldn't be enough. Not without several major and minor miracles, but the line had to be held. Failing to do so would mean falling to an empire that was willing to unleash beasts like the Drossen on innocent worlds. It was more than merely unthinkable. It was intolerable. Eric pushed those thoughts away.
He had to avoid falling into the same trap he was working so hard to keep his crew from. Worrying about the enemy wouldn't solve the problem of their approach. Only working on solutions could do that. He called up the latest from Mila's drone project, checking the general status reports from the different groups involved. Most of the work was continuing apace, with space frames being turned out as fast as the ship's fab units could manage, and propulsion and control systems basically dropped in without issue. The antimatter and transition cannon designs were a little trickier, particularly since testing couldn't exactly be done while the drones were on the Odysseus. Only one man had ever been so mind-numbingly insane as to expose his own damned ship to antimatter, and Eric had personally ordered that he never be allowed anywhere near the Odysseus. Chief Duin from the Autolycus was a stone-cold badass, of that there was no doubt, but Eric didn't want the man within 2 light minutes of his ship. Luckily, as commodore of his task force, he had a lot to say about it. Eric shivered, just thinking about the mission reports filed by the Auto's Captain Passer. An induced antimatter enema for the ship might have topped the cake, but the bizarre star gun built into an entire alien world, albeit a small one, that was populated by dragons? I thought we got the strange missions. He set aside those thoughts, cursing his tendency to get sidetracked, while simultaneously realizing it meant that he was getting tired and mentally fatigued. He closed down the files and rose from his station.
"Commander," he said to Miram, who was working across the way, "you have the bridge. I'm going to check on some of the side projects. If the Enterprise arrives, let me know."
"Aye, Captain, I have the bridge," Heath said automatically. "I'll have you paged if the Big E arrives in system."
"No need for that. It'll be hours before we rendezvous anyway," Eric said. "Just send a notification to my systems."
"Yes, sir."
"Thank you, Commander. I'll be back shortly," he said as he left.
Eric was silent as he stepped onto the open decks where the engineers had taken over, assembling the space frames Mila had designed and quickly installing all the off-the-shelf components they could while the final designs for the more esoteric pieces were put through their paces in simulations before real-world testing could be completed. They were rushing everything faster than he would normally be comfortable with, but when you were up against the wall, you did what you could with what you had. He spotted Odysseus, also silently looking over the work, and briefly wondered what the young intelligence was thinking, as if that was a talisman to summon the boy, and Eric supposed it likely was. Odysseus turned and marched in his direction, looking like something out of a historical documentary. Eric wondered curiously whether actual hoplite soldiers marched like that, or if what he was seeing was the result of modern expectations.
"Captain?"
Odysseus said formally as he came to a stop beside Eric's position.
"Odysseus," Eric returned the respect, "how are things progressing?"
"They appear to be moving along as expected so far,"
the boy replied, his formal tone bringing a twitch to Eric's lips as he tried to keep from smiling. Just the thought seemed to put Odysseus out slightly, though, and the rigid soldier vanished to be replaced by the young boy.
"Did I speak improperly?"
Odysseus said, his voice just a little plaintive.
"No, I'm sorry," Eric chuckled, not able to keep it in any longer. "It has to do with your apparent age and how people perceive children who act overly grown up."
Odysseus pouted slightly, looking down at his body.
"I don't understand why I am in this form. I'm immaterial. Shouldn't I be able to choose what people see?"
"We rarely get to choose how other people see us, Odysseus," Eric said softly, "however much we might try. Don't worry too much about how you look. Just focus on what you want to become in the future."
"I am a warrior. I will be a warrior."
"There are warriors, and then there are warriors, Odysseus," Eric said with a very slight frown. "But Odysseus was more than a warrior in the epic. I hope you know."
"I do. He was also a king."
"And a father," Eric said, "and a navigator, a sea captain, a diplomat when necessary, and a clever man who knew that fighting was not always the solution he should seek. He was also foolish and arrogant, a man who knew the gods existed and yet chose to mock them anyway. The Romans knew him as the liar Odysseus, a man who shirked his duty. The Greeks revered him as a cultural hero,
If he existed in reality, he was probably all of these things. People are complicated. Odysseus looked down, his face a mask of confusion.
But I am named after him. Should I not model myself after him?
Take what you like of his story. Aspire to that. But don't try to be anyone other than the very best you that can be managed, Eric said. We don't become heroes or legends, Odysseus. We take one step at a time, solve each problem as it arises, and we let the rest handle itself as it will. We can't control how we're seen, but we can control how we see.
I do not understand, Odysseus admitted slowly.
You will, and probably sooner than later, so don't worry about it for now, Eric responded as he refocused his attention across the deck and winced involuntarily. Ouch, Steph is going to kill me.
What?
Odysseus looked up, seemingly distracted enough to have initially missed Eric's reaction and thoughts. He followed the captain's gaze, turning himself back into the thoughts around him, and saw what had prompted that reaction.
Oh, is that going to be as bad as I believe it to be?
Steph is going to blow his top, Eric confirmed, smiling a little ruefully. But I gave her blanket authorization. Mila and a small crew of engineer ratings had swarmed over Steph's Archangel and had already succeeded in ripping the twin power plants right out of the airframe with the overhead loading gantry. She was intent on welding in the framework to drop a Primine shuttle warp core in the reactor's place, which was a neat trick. If it worked out, he would probably get her to mod his own fighter. He was plenty glad that she wasn't experimenting on his, though.
You will need a pilot for that, Odysseus pointed out.
Yep, and there's only one on board I trust with it besides myself. I hope Steph has trained his department well, because at least one Archangel is going to taste vacuum again soon.
Miriam Heath looked up when the soft alarm chime sounded, checking the computer automatically without pausing in her work. It was a proximity alarm tied to the long-range scanners, alerting her to the arrival of a small squadron of Primine heroics. They were expecting more of the same over the next few days, while the Odysseus completed its official task of working back up to fighting form and, unofficially, worked to get everyone used to the presence of the Deus Ex Machina that now inhabited the ship. Like most everyone on board, she had her reservations concerning Odysseus, but Miriam had to admit that moments arose when she looked forward to what the entity would become with some level of anticipation. She knew that she was just seeing mere hints of what he was capable of, and she was already impressed. Odysseus could interface with the ship's computers, analyze information through the eyes of every member of the crew, provide intelligence on any person who stepped foot on the deck of the big ship. She truly suspected that was only the very tip of the iceberg when dealing with Odysseus. Ultimately, she had no doubt that he could do great things. She was just terrified of the mistakes he could make along the way. Odysseus had already gotten a lot of good men and women killed, and he'd really only woken up and tried to live up to the expectations the crew placed on his name. His excitement at the prospect of battle was the sort of thing only a child could have truly emulated, which proved neatly that while the intelligence might have all the crew members' thoughts, it did not have their experience. The people lost in that headlong rush at the enemy were a hard lesson, or she hoped they were at least. If the boy shrugged the lesson off too easily, then the great things he would inevitably accomplish in the future might well be terrible things too. There was no moral compass to greatness, sadly. She knew he had the one inside him. She just prayed he had both. Another chime distracted her from her line of thoughts, this time slightly different. She looked over to the repeater screen she had tied into the scanner station, and her eyes widened as she recognized the transponder codes.
"Well, well, welcome to the war," she said to the screen, shaking her head slightly. "Not sure what you'll be able to do, but somehow I feel a little better with the Enterprise in the fray."
Miriam smiled tightly, eyes darting about the screen as she noted the rest of the icons. The Admiral had come through, with a dozen more rogues appearing and two heroics that had been assigned to home fleet defense.
The Commodore will be pleased, she thought.
The Geronimo and the Qin Shi would significantly add to the power they could bring to bear.
She entered the date into the system and copied it to the Commodore, settling back to return her focus to her tasks at hand. The ship was ready. The crew was ready. She just hoped Odysseus was ready. Whether he was or not, however, time was up. The warrior king was going to war. AEV Enterprise ran keel system.
All systems green. The ship is good to go, Skipper.
James knew without doubt that he had to have a sickly green look to his face, but he stoically refused to acknowledge its existence as he stiffly nodded.
Thank you, Ensign, he told the young woman at the ship's communication center.
Secure the vessel from transition alert. They'd transitioned into the system sometime earlier, but as it had been their first transition in some time, he had maintained alert while all systems were properly checked. The Enterprise had taken its place in the line of battle that was now loitering in the outer Rankiel system, and while she was a small ship, even compared to the Rogues, he'd be damned to hell if she came up short in any way that mattered. The two heroics the Admiral had shaken loose, including the she, he was stunned that she'd managed to convince the Bloc to give up one of their best ships to the cause, took up the center of the formation. The massive vessels were surrounded by a dozen Rogues and several dozen Collier vessels, with supplies and munitions for the task force. All in all, over 100 ships had just entered the Primenae's main star system, loaded for bear and looking for targets. Unfortunately, from what they had on the enemy, targets would shortly be in plentiful supply.
"Signal from the Odysseus," the communications officer said, looking up. "She welcomes us to Rankiel and attaches rendezvous coordinates, sir."
"Send them to the helm, Ensign," James said. "We're here to do a job."
"Aye, aye, Skipper."
The Enterprise was shortly shifting course, along with the rest of the formation, keeping the ships to the edge of the heliosphere as they awaited the arrival of the Odysseus and her Primenae companions. James eyed the telemetry that showed the formation rising up from the Rankiel Primary's gravity well on course to meet them, and couldn't help but wonder why the Odysseus was separated from her task group. The official story wasn't unlikely, but something didn't ring true about it to him either. It wasn't hard to believe that Weston had managed to take the brunt of the fighting in such a way as to more severely damage the Odysseus, but the repair times in the report seemed like overkill for anything short of building an entirely new ship. Since he was pretty certain that hadn't happened, James figured there was more going on than he'd been told.
"The Odysseus and escorts will rendezvous with us in 4 hours, sir."
"Thank you, Ensign. I suppose we just get to relax a little and wait," James said as he smiled. Some things in the service just never changed. Hurry up and wait, my boys. Hurry up and wait. AEV Odysseus. Steph reread his orders again, uncertain what to make of them. He certainly wasn't going to object, of course. If the Commodore wanted him flight-checked on the AA platform, that was nothing but good news to him. It did arouse a certain suspicious curiosity, however, since he was well aware that there was not a damn thing an Archangel could do against what the Imperial fleet was likely to throw in their direction.
"What are you up to, Rays?"
Steph reserved some simulator time before doing anything else, though he was relatively certain he could qualify. It was never a bad thing to brush off a little of the rust before a qual flight run. Then he queried the computer for a location of the captain. "Best way to figure out Rays is to start by asking him to his face," Steph thought as he got the location of a flight deck and started off in that direction. Asking the man might not get him anything, but would hopefully knock a few options off the table depending on how the Commodore responded. Steph hoped that there was a new doctrine coming down the pipe that included fighters, but with Rays fixated on drones, he doubted it. A morbid thought crossed his mind then, and Steph faltered in mid-step. "Aw, crap. He better not be planning on putting one of those antimatter chuckers on my fighter." There were limits to how reckless he was willing to be, even in pursuit of the fighter jock image, and Steph drew that line right before he'd let anyone load his fighter up with the nightmare fuel that was antimatter. No way, no chance. He continued to steel himself to tell Eric just where he could get off if and when the man made that suggestion, mumbling to himself with more and more agitation the closer he got to the flight deck. Steph didn't notice other crew members steering a wide berth around him as his affable amble became more of a stalking motion with each passing moment. After a few minutes, he found the right deck and stepped off the lift with the intention of locating Eric. He couldn't help but throw a fond and longing glance in the direction of his fighter, mostly on reflex. What he saw wiped all thoughts of Eric from his mind, along with practically everything else. His angel, his fighter, his one and only true love was in pieces and strewn across the busy deck, looking like it had been hacked by some vengeful psycho he had unknowingly offended. Steph froze in place, staring in unadulterated horror at the scene until he finally found his voice. "What the ever-living f—" He blew, his voice rising with each word until by the end, every person on the deck was looking at him with varying expressions of shock, humor, or stunned confusion. Steph started moving, hands twitching as they reflexively tried to find something to wrap themselves around, heading straight for his baby. Chapter 16 AEV Bellerophon, Outer System. Jason Roberts stared grim-faced at the screens, hating that he was forced to stand and watch the scene that was unfolding. Even if he had the forces, it would hardly have made much difference, of course, as they were looking at something that had happened hours earlier. Light speed was painfully slow by even stellar distances, to say nothing of interstellar ones, and the small task group he currently commanded was so insufficient to the current task that they hadn't dared to break cover to approach the colonial planet. The orbital bombardment shouldn't have been a surprise to him, not really, but when the first kinetic strikes lanced out from the fleet, his guts had twisted. Part of him really believed that the Imperials would secure the colony and claim it as part of the Empire. That was what was expected in his view of war. One didn't wage genocidal war. What was the point? War was to claim resources. There was no other sane reason for it. Of course, these were the people who had unleashed the Drossen on the galaxy. Genocide was mild compared to that atrocity, in his opinion. Jason's knuckles were blanched, glaringly so against his skin, the force of his clenched fist making his nails cut into the palm of his hand as he felt an utterly consuming rage building inside him. He didn't know the Primenae well, and didn't know anyone on the planet below at all, but he didn't need to. God damn them. The words were a whisper, floating around the command deck. Sometimes they seemed to morph into another similar but different phrasing. Jason never recognized the voice, and didn't really care. The sentiment was fitting. God damn them, indeed. "Sir, the Imperials are launching ships to the surface," his scanner tech announced. "Give me the best view you can," he ordered. The scanner's acuity, even at such an insane range, was impressive, the result of a widespread series of scanners on every ship in the task group, all working together. For a moment, he didn't care about the technical details. The image was good enough to make out individual hulls as they broke away from the main group and entered the atmosphere. "Looks like they're going to occupy the world after all," Robert said flatly. "Why would they bombard the colony like that, then?" his first officer asked softly. "Pacification? Maybe just an object lesson?" Robert said simply. "At least they left someone alive." He tapped a command and brought the image zoom out, enough to show the whole fleet. The swarm of ships blotted out part of the planet and the sun beyond at that zoom, sending a shiver down his spine. "What should we do?" his first officer asked.
"Do?"
"Nothing. There's nothing we can do," Roberts answered, a sickly taste in his mouth. "We watch. We wait. And when they leave, we mark their course and then... then we can do something." Lord's own dreadnought, Empress Lian. Yesan stood stoically as he watched the fires burn from orbit, smoke filling enough area to be easily visible even without magnification. The fires themselves showed up through the smoke as the Terminator advanced slowly, turning day to night, and the smoke took on an ominous and evil glow. "All significant infrastructure has been eliminated, my lord," his adjutant said, approaching from behind.
"Excellent. And phase two?"
"A garrison structure has been launched, along with the forces to more than pacify the remaining population.
With the approaching drop in local temperatures expected from the dust and smoke we filled the sky with, they can be expected to have difficulty meeting their nourishment needs for the foreseeable future. How many survivors? Approximately 80%, with 5 to 10% margin for error, the adjutant said.
Excellent. My compliments to the gunners, Yesan said. With farmland, power and transport systems, and various other vital sectors in ruins, the colony belonged to the Empire. The survivors would need to eat, and he had just made certain that if they wanted to do so and hoped to live, with their families no less, then they would soon be beholden to the Empire. Any new infrastructure would be gifts from the Empress, as it should be. Inform the fleet that as soon as we've completed landing operations, we will be moving on to the next target.
Yes, my lord. Will we leave any ships to secure the orbitals?
Why bother?
Of course, my lord. I will see to it that the orders are issued.
Miesan merely waved, his attention turning back to the burning smoke on the world below. It was a small step, of course, but an important and symbolic one. The first world the Empire had taken in this sector, and the first world secured from the control of the Oathers themselves. The Empire would record it as a momentous date, but the procurement was merely the first step of many. He gestured with his hand, clearing the screen, and refocusing out beyond the reach of the local star to the black beyond. Yesan was still troubled by the weapons they'd encountered coming into the system. There had been no indications that the colony was capable of any sort of operation of that nature, and if it had been, then Yesan would have expected far more of the weapons. The measly few they located were so insufficient to the task that it was actually amusing, or would have been if the weapons hadn't been placed so precisely correct as to intercept his fleet. Someone is out there, he thought with certainty. Those damn nigh-invisible ships that had been reported by the early probes and confirmed by the Navark's experiences. Small pests, but able to maneuver around with near impunity due to their low power curves and adaptable camouflage systems. Thankfully, the Navark's last foray had shown that the Imperial response to their most serious weapon would be effective. That was a great relief, as he had no desire to experience his ship's interactions with negative matter. Really, what sort of lunatics store that on board their own ship? In combat, no less. He knew that they had to be storing it, given that they showed almost no power curve and producing negative matter took no small degree of power to accomplish. It was remotely possible, of course, that they had discovered a less power-intensive method, but he doubted that. Still, with those weapons largely neutralized, he had thought that the invisible vessels would be of little concern. Now he saw otherwise. 4 ships lost, and we never fired a shot in our defense until it was over. I begin to see what the Navark meant when she stressed that they were not to be underestimated. They have sneaky minds, these anomalies.
My lord, his adjutant said, deployment operations have concluded.
Very good. Issue the orders to break orbit. We have other systems to pacify.
AEV Bellerophon.
That's it. They're moving out.
Jason Roberts nodded, eyes on the plot he knew was hours old. The enemy fleet was steadily climbing up out of the star's gravity well, heading away from where his task group was hiding out, on a vector that would bring them deeper into Primine territory and, incidentally, closer to Earth.
Show me the planet. Best magnification, he ordered.
There was no need to rush concerning the enemy fleet, as it would take them hours to clear the cluttered inner system. No fleet commander would be crazy enough to order a translite acceleration that deep inside a gravity well. Not outside of combat, at least, and hardly enough even then. Too much debris kicking around, waiting to be turned into ballistic threats. The main display flickered, showing the planet as closely as their combined scanners could manage. The smoke was obscuring the better part of a continent already, and dust from the kinetic strikes had spread the light spectrum spectacularly into the reds. The sky was lit up such that it seemed to burn in sympathy with the ground below, and he wondered just how many had survived the bombardment, or would survive what was to come.
We could go secure the world, sir.
Jason shook his head.
No,
We'd only be wasting our time. The next world is under threat, too, and the one after that, and so on. As soon as the Imperials clear the system and go to warp, I want their vector calculated. We transition ahead of them and make them pay for this as best we can. Just before we jump, send a transit message to Primine Central Command about what happened here. He sighed, shaking his head again before he went on. I'm afraid they'll have to clean up this mess themselves.
Yes, sir.
There was a nearly invisible Casimir flash as the Imperial fleet reached the outer system and went translite on their warp drives, the blue glow gone almost the instant it appeared, and with it, the ships themselves. Across the black, two hulking heroics and their smaller rogues silently emerged from hiding and began moving under power to the system's edge. Already far out in the outer system, they broke the light-speed barrier with similar blue flashes almost immediately, speeding out well past the reach of the local star before they turned in the direction in which the Imperial fleet had vanished, and then were gone themselves in a puff of tachyons. Chapter 17 AEV Odysseus, Rankiel System. Eric intercepted Steph in mid-stride, catching the angry man and lifting him right up off his feet, then swinging him about before he could make it halfway to his chopped-up fighter.
"Whoa there, partner," Eric said, grinning as he held the angry man.
"Raise! My bird! What did she do to it?"
Steph wailed, gesturing wildly over Eric's shoulder.
"Lord, I wish that was the first time I'd heard you say something like that."
Steph shot him a betrayed look before retorting angrily,
"Oh, shut it! At least I've never looked up how to get a tattoo removed from there."
"Not like I knew it was temporary at the time," Eric laughed. "As blitzed as we were, it could have been real."
Steph snorted.
"More than a few of us wound up with real ones that night."
He paused, eyes flashing angrily again.
"Don't distract me! What the hell is going on with my fighter?"
"I authorized it," Eric said evenly, letting his friend go. "So relax and stop trying to fry Lieutenant Shans with your eyes." Steph glanced toward the Primine woman, who was staring back at him with wide eyes and a shocked expression, and sighed.
"Fine. What exactly did you authorize that involves pulling the reactors?"
Steph grumbled, looking at the scattered pieces of his fighters strewn around the deck. Still, he noticed sections of tech were neatly arranged in order of removal, best he could tell, and nothing looked busted at least.
"Upgrade," Eric said,
gesturing to a gantry that was holding up something Steph didn't recognize. He ran his hand through his hair.
"Okay, I'll bite. What's that?"
"That is a Primine shuttle's warp generator," Eric replied. "We're refitting your Angel for modern combat." Steph walked around the bulbous-looking warp generator, shaking his head.
"Gonna look weird as hell, boss."
"How fast will the fighter accelerate when you're done, Mila?" Eric asked over his shoulder.
"Mass calculations indicate that, fully loaded, the craft should be able to exceed light speed in just under 8 minutes," Mila replied as she approached.
Steph choked, clutching at his chest as he started coughing.
"Odysseus can barely do it in an hour," he sputtered out, shocked.
"The Odysseus exceeds your fighter's mass by..."
Mila paused, eyes rolling back and to the right as she thought furiously for a moment before giving up.
"By an amount that defies calculation. The singularity alone is measured in planetary masses, Stefan. Accelerating the Odysseus is more akin to doing the same to a small planet than a ship. Though that is actually a very bad analogy for a number of reasons."
Steph nodded slowly.
"Weird isn't so bad." "We have some more toys being rigged for you to play with, Stephanos," Eric said seriously, using his call sign for the first time in a while, grabbing Steph's attention. "It's time to live up to your handle. So, for all our sakes, I hope you've trained your department well."
Primine Central Command, Rankiel. Tanner looked over the latest report, his mood not helped even slightly by what he was reading.
"It seems that the Imperials have altered their tactics this time," he thought grimly.
Bombarding a colony world should have bothered him less than the Drossen just annihilating entire planets as they did. but somehow he felt the gut-wrenching pain just as viscerally. Tanner couldn't help but look up the population of the colony, a number that had been hovering just over 3 million people. It was a small site, of course, one of the new explorations since the Drossen encounter, still years away from being ready for proper forming. The world would take decades before a full-scale occupation was possible,